All right, let's just go. Wait. Hello and welcome to another episode of Not Another Sports Show here on 104.5 LPFM, your progressive look at the world of sports. But before we get started, Damien, as always, our
Yeah,
wonderful
our little
disclaimer.
disclaimer, WRFU is an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent those of the UCIMC, WRFU, or the Urbana Socialist Forum.
Okay, with us today in studio is
screaming a very... children in the background. And...
yeah, somebody go shut the door, so hold on one moment.
It's IMC Fest here, so it's kind of an open house, and we have a busy facility here right now, which is good. We appreciate that.
Okay,
but,
not another sports show, now with less screaming child. with us today in studio is a very special guest, a U of I professor in history, Dr. Adrian Burgos. And with me, as always, is the blazing ignorance to my Jerry Schweigert statement on film, Damien Matthew. Just a quick editorial comment from Not Another Sports Show about that video. Okay, back to our regular schedule.
For those who aren't aware, Jerry Schweigert, the mayor of Champaign, was caught on video, I guess, voicing his beliefs that Obama is not an actual citizen of the United States.
Yes, stay classy, Jerry. And then the front page today was, it was my opinion. I could have lied about my opinion. Even better, you could have just not said anything.
Yeah, it's like, or you could be an intelligent person and have, like, a legitimate opinion.
And so today we're going to quickly go through our news of the week and spend most of the hour talking with Professor Burgos about the history of Latinos in baseball. He is the author of Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line, which is a very excellent book, which I got for Christmas and ended up reading. The very first news story this week, April 15th, was the 63rd anniversary of Jackie Robinson Day. And African-Americans now make up only 9.3% of MLB opening day rosters. There were 17 teams with two or fewer African-American players on their opening day roster. Minnesota Twins second baseman Orlando Hudson had some comments about aging black players that are still free agents like Jermaine Dye, saying, quote, "You see guys like Jermaine Dye without a job. Guy with good numbers and can't get a job. Pretty much sums it up there, no? You got some guys who miss a year and then come back and get $5 million, $6 million, and a guy like Jermaine Dye can't get a job. A guy like Gary Sheffield, a first ballot Hall of Famer, can't get a job. We both know what it is. You'll get it right. You'll figure it out. I'm not going to say what it is, because then I'll be in trouble." And very clearly, I think we can all figure out what he's talking about there, of allegations of racism in the signing and or not signing of athletes.
Right.
Which kind of also goes along with the collusion claims that MLBPA is alleging of owners, that they had colluded to keep certain players from making more money.
Right, right.
Now, Damien, I know one of your favorite sports is professional golf.
I didn't actually get the run sheet this week, so you'll have to...
Well, I know Damien's one of his favorite things is professional golf.
Yeah, let's talk about golf.
And so...
what's Tiger been up to?
No, it's actually not about Tiger Woods.
Not about Tiger Woods, okay.
You know, we talked enough about his brand last week on the radio show.
Uh-huh.
It seems golf writer Dan Jenkins, during his coverage of the Masters tournament, sent out the following tweet.
Okay.
Y.E. Yang is only 3 shots off the lead. I think we got takeout from him last night.
Oh, boy.
I hope he can, you know, this is radio, so he can't see my face palm, but I'm doing it as hard as I can. And you should have the run sheet now, Damien.
All right.
Yes, things are a little haphazard here this week because it is IMC Fest at 202 South Broadway, and you had been listening to some great live music earlier, and there'll be live music later today. Now, right. Players and coaches of the AFL, the Australian Rules Soccer League, Damien.
I'm listening.
Have launched a campaign against homophobia, which is seen quite widely as a very positive step by gay men, in a sport seen by gay men in a recent survey as being both hostile and threatening.
Sure, yeah.
The campaign is timed to meet with the May 17th International Day Against Homophobia. Almost 30 players and coaches have signed up to the Players Association's project, which will be officially launched in May. The sportsmen and coaches have been photographed holding handwritten signs calling for acceptance and understanding of homosexuals. And I've got to sit down and look at a few of the signs, and there are some really excellent signs of, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who you date, it's how you play.
Okay.
That kind of stuff.
That's good.
And, you know, acceptance for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of your favorite athletes, Ben Roethlisberger. If you want to take this one, Damien.
Let me see. What's Ben Roethlisberger up to? Okay, so Ben Roethlisberger will officially not face criminal charges for the allegations of sexual assault. Like last week, we had sort of covered the rumor that they would likely not be pressing charges. So now it looks like it's official. The Steelers and the NFL are waiting 2 weeks until after the NFL draft to punish Ben under the league's personal conduct policy. The documents released show prior allegations as well as the details of the Milledgeville allegations.
Yes, one of my favorites of those is the allegations where he came out and said, all of my bees, and you can fill in the blank, take some shots, and then proceeded to whip out his privates to the alleged victim.
Oh, for crying out loud. Yeah.
Amongst other things, there's going to be some really entertaining signs in Pittsburgh this season.
That's unbelievably awful. Anyway, DK Wilson of Sports on My Mind made a fantastic connection between the Georgia DA and other cases where sexual assaults are prosecuted without the victim's cooperation. Look at the Georgia DA's ability to indict. Is the name Jennerlo Wilson, a 17-year-old African American who had received a mandatory minimum 10-year prison sentence for receiving consensual sex from a 15-year-old girl. It was overturned after 2 years in prison. And after media treatment, who's been demanding every last sort of detail, a la Tiger Woods debacle, here we have
The exact
dead
opposite.
Silence. Yeah.
Yes, we don't want to know what happened.
Yeah.
We don't. And even Tony Kornheiser, you know, started bringing up, and this is actually hitting some mainstream coverage, of the disparity. You know, you can't have one standard of justice for a black cornerback, Adam Pac-Man Jones, and have a very different one for a white quarterback, because this isn't the first set of allegations. And even during this investigation in the papers, they'd also said that they were looking at another person had known of another third case where this had potentially happened, where he had her in his house and was attempting to grope her, allegedly.
Oh, jeez.
And so, you know, you have one system of justice here, or are you going to have a very different set of rules for a white quarterback compared to a black cornerback? And watching ESPN, well, he didn't have a gun when he did this. Oh, that makes it any better, you know? Oh, physical. It wasn't it wasn't physical gun violence assault. Yeah, it was sexual assault, which is a whole lot more traumatic.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it was just it was a bad joke, right? In the case of Pac-Man, it was just, really poor taste.
Oh no, Pac-Man Jones is also
no one got hurt.
The strip club shooting and stuff.
Oh right. Well,
yes.
Okay, yeah.
Gilbert Arenas, you're thinking of.
Yeah. Never mind.
A Maryland student was seriously injured after the Maryland Terrapins beat Duke last month, and he was injured by the police. The cops had claimed that he had attacked mounted policemen and was kicked by their horses. Let's go to the videotape! Oh, what's this? Oh, the cops are dirty liars. The video that was just released shows 19-year-old John McKenna coming upon two mounted police officers who block his way. After stopping and slowly backing up, three cops in full riot gear push him into a brick wall and then begin pummeling him with nightsticks before leaving him unconscious on the pavement. It does not appear that he even touched the horses and certainly did not cause minor injuries to them, as the officers claimed in their initial sworn statements. But an excellent good college try, guys. At least one officer involved has already been suspended, and the Prince George's County Police Chief says the rest may be fired before it's all over. The charges against McKenna for inciting a crowd have since been dropped, and students and lawyers say that he was not the only one attacked that night. So, you know, I guess if there's going to be one benefit of having these random security cameras all over the place, it does even stop the police from, you know, being able to lie and do things.
No, I think, like, these, dashboard cams on police cruisers and things like that have I mean, I've only been seeing, and it might just be my personal bias, but I've only been seeing a video that's showing the cops in a terrible light, you know, dragging women out of minivans in front of their kids and beating them, you know, just crazy. And they know the camera's there, right? I mean, I just don't get it. You guys can't act with impunity anymore.
Yep.
Anyway. Very amusing.
And speaking of acting with impunity, a nice little community victory. The second youth that had survived the police killing of Kiwan Carrington had his charges dropped. And according to Julia Reitz, it was
nothing to do with the petitions.
Yeah, it was not due to community activism. It was not due to community pressure, phone calls, and petitions. Yeah, it was not due to any of that. So lest you think that community activism actually does things, you know.
Yeah.
He's no longer going to be charged because he went to a 6-week parenting class.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Man, if I knew people could get out of felonies going to 6-week classes.
Yeah, no, that's ridiculous. Yeah, but she mentioned it like 3 or 4 times in the press conference, right? It's, or in your statements, it's like, no, but just to be clear, the thousands of petitions I received had nothing to do with this. That's why you keep mentioning it, right?
Yes, it had nothing to do with it.
Oh, quite amusing.
And the New Jersey legislature is now investigating an inquiry into the sale of the Nets to Mikhail Prokhorov, the major Russian billionaire that they're partially building the Atlantic Fields project for to put the Nets in.
That's right.
You know, nothing says, you know, great season like 70 losses in a new stadium. It appears that Prokhorov may or may not have done business with the Liberian dictator Robert Mugabe, or sorry, the Zimbabwe dictator Robert Mugabe. According to the New York Post, his investment fund has a subsidiary that owns several companies in Zimbabwe, including a mining operation and a big game reserve. Well, if you check your law books, it's illegal for U.S. citizens, U.S. companies, or subsidiaries of U.S. companies to do business with Mugabe or any of his associates. Therefore, it's illegal to do business with Zimbabwe. So if he does buy the Nets, he's going to have a very big issue on his hands.
That's interesting. Wah, wah, wah.
And yes, I think that's the very fastest we've ever gotten through the news of the week, because we have a very special guest that we've been wanting to have on the show, Professor Adrian Burgos. Again, U of I professor in history, the author of Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line. You'd say hi to our nationwide podcast audience and our relatively limited actual live audience.
Our as a low power station, RFU covers several city blocks of Urbana.
Does it reach Savoy?
It breaks the static in Savoy, actually.
If the wind's blowing right. Well, thanks for having me on.
We just have to have Schweigert talk in the right direction and we'll start blowing our airwaves that way.
All the hot air.
That's right.
Well, the last few weeks we've spent on this show, we talked a little bit about the history of Lester Rodney and helping to break the color line and getting a lot of popular consensus out there about that. Last week, we went and talked a little bit more about the actual Jackie Robinson, how he was a little bit more controversial instead of this person, you know, calm as a Hindu cow, or what did people most remember? 42 Dodgers, 1947 color line breaking, and that's it. And so we kind of went into more of, you know, the social issues that revolved around, you know, coming in, you know, what his childhood was like, you know, what he had grown up doing, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and a lot of those kind of situations. And so, obviously, you know, we're going to keep talking about baseball since, you know, it's just the opening weeks of baseball season. And you're one of the groundbreaking historians into the history of Latinos in baseball. And so I wanted to ask first, you know, what made you interested in this topic?
I've always loved baseball. I played in Little League, high school, college, Division III, not that good. I've always been fascinated by history as well. And so this was a way of bringing together my interest in baseball, my love of history, And looking at my own roots, my family's from the Caribbean, from Puerto Rico, and even growing up, we talked a lot about the various ball players. And my grandparents, that is my grandmothers, were big baseball fans. And one of the special times we would have is Tuesday Night Baseball. We were living in New York, and we watch Tuesday Night Baseball on WPIX, and grandma cooked me dinner, and we sit there and talk baseball and history and stuff like that. So I really wanted to discover what was the base of that fascination for the game. And I did a senior thesis in college on it. And what I learned blew my mind, because I learned Latinos had actually played in Negro Leagues. Lifelong baseball fan. In fact, I describe myself as a third generation baseball fan within my family. My grandparents, again, my grandmothers loved the game. My parents are fans. I'm a fan. And yet, I really didn't know about this history. And it's one thing that if there was just like two or three Latinos that played in Negro Leagues. But in fact, the ratio of Latinos who played in the Negro Leagues during the era of segregation, before the color line was broken by Robinson, versus those who were guided, ushered into the major leagues during this period, was by a ratio of over 4-1. So there was over 230 Latinos from Cuba, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Mexico, Venezuela that played in the Negro Leagues. And there was 50-some-odd players who played in the major leagues during that period. I needed to understand that story. And understand why isn't that story talked about. You know, and as I go around, give talks at different universities, at bookstores and stuff, early on, one of the reactions I would get is, so are you trying to diminish the story of Jackie Robinson? I said, not at all. I'm trying to help you understand why Jackie Robinson was so important, that major league team execs like Clark Griffith, scouts like Joe Cambria and others had so manipulated the color line to allow increasingly darker skinned, what I call in the book, racially ambiguous Latinos into Major League Baseball, that you actually needed an unambiguous black U.S.-born player to shatter the illusion, to shatter the ambiguity. And that guy was Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, you know, like we kind of talked about how the most historical talks about baseball go from segregation, integration, and after April 15th, 1947, celebration! Everything's all okay! And everything's so wonderful.
Well, and you were mentioning before about Robinson. What fascinates me is people commemorate the 1947 Robinson. They don't acknowledge, for the most part, 48 until his death in 1972. What's amazing is, look at the last moment Jackie Robinson graced a Major League Baseball field. World Series between the Mets and Orioles. And he wasn't even going to come out. He had to be assured by Bowie Kuhn that they were going to make, that his Major League Baseball was going to make a sincere effort at beginning to hire African-American managers. And Robinson was strong, even in the midst of a debilitating battle with diabetes. He was adamant about, you must do something more, that this wasn't the vision of integration that he had started fighting for in 47. And I asked on Jackie Robinson Day, do people consider the work of integration over in baseball and even beyond? And, to me, integration is a process. It's more than the inclusion of difference. It is moving toward a better institution of baseball. It's moving toward a better society. And in that sense, we're always in, and sometimes my student says, look at the Declaration of Independence. It says to create a more perfect union. That's incorrect grammar. But there's actually something they're trying to say. A more perfect. It's a process. It's movement. It's never stopping. And that, to me, is part of what, my work attempts to do with the story of baseball. Add another layer of complexity to it. But let people understand the vital lessons of it. And Robinson played a role in that. But also a lot of Latinos played a role in that. Troy Hunter recently made statements about black Dominicans being imposters. And Torrey is very much in the right place when he's talking about Major League Baseball needs to do more to reach out to African-American communities. But to call black Latinos like Vladimir Guerrero imposters, you have a flawed sense of the history of the game. As I was saying before, the majority of Latinos played in the Negro Leagues during the era of segregation. It wasn't because they weren't good enough to play in the major leagues, because they were black. enough stated. That was the reason. And to understand that story is to actually appreciate the Negro League story even more, because they were more international than Major League Baseball. They were more accepting than Major League Baseball. And they opened different opportunities. There were black Cubans managing Negro League teams in 1926. There was an owner of a Negro League team from the very beginning of formal organization of the Negro Leagues in 1920. That story is so different than the Major League story. We're still waiting for the first black owner in the Major Leagues. We have the first Latino owner in the Major Leagues. But what are the roots of that story? And Roberto Clemente, who is one of my favorites, he stated it very bluntly when he was asked about how did he feel or how did others perceive him. And he said, basically, I'm a double N-word, and fill in the blanks, right? He said, they see me that way because I'm black and because I'm Puerto Rican. And whereas most people, and perhaps Tory Hunter is included in that group, see that the black Dominicans and black Latinos are kind of getting away with something, Clemente said something very different. And I would say that Tory Hunter's statements were, in fact, indicative of what Clemente was complaining about.
Now, April 15th, as we've mentioned, was Jackie Robinson Day. And as you noted in the book, 13 of the 16 Major League teams prior to 1947 had at least one Latino player in uniform before Robinson's debut. And throughout the book, you talk about, the ambiguity of, the polar opposites of white versus black in the color line, and how this process, what do you think accounts for the exclusion of, the lack of discussion about the color brown and the typical black-white discussion when it came to race in Major League Baseball? I never remember in your book when you had mentioned, you'd asked during a Negro Leagues convention, well, what about this team? And like, well, they weren't important enough.
I'll never forget that. It was one of the first Negro League conferences I had attended. And what Neil's referring to is that I was looking at to purchase this particular T-shirt that had all the emblems of the Negro League baseball teams on it. And then I noticed that the New York Cubans were not, and I'm actually wearing a New York Cubans jersey today, that they were not included on this. And I asked them, and the response was that they were not important. And it's like, again, the flawed understanding. And I actually, in various places, have argued in some academic articles and public writing, have argued that this is more a construction or a perception rooted in the recovery of the story of the Negro Leagues than of what the Negro Leaguers understood, and even the black community and the Latino community understood during that particular era. This is then the reinvention or the recovery of the story. Most people didn't give much attention to the Negro League story till Bob Peterson wrote this fantastic book called Only the Ball Was White. And that started a fascination and even exploration of Negro League story. And yet, most of the individuals who are writing or recovering the history of the Negro Leagues tended to be white and non-Spanish speaking. And so they colored the story of the game by their own inability to be bilingual, to go to, well, most people still can't go to Cuba to do research, but to interview the Cuban players, to interview the Puerto Rican players, the Dominican players, and they actually missed a vital part of the story. Now, they did interview some of these players, but they interviewed them in English, and for many of these players, that is their second language, and you couldn't capture the stories, and they didn't consult the Spanish language newspapers in terms of their stories to really get the full flavor of what was like for Latinos in the Negro Leagues. And that's why I try to capture it in the book, Playing America's Game.
You had mentioned a few different famous people that don't necessarily get talked about, like Vincent Nava. That story was entirely new to me as I was reading the book. And it was one, it was very interesting to read, how they were able to, play off the color line. Oh, well, he's not black, and then coming up with, he's, Castilian, he's Spanish, he's from Spain, he's from upper class society in Spain, he's not black. And being able to bring them in that way, and even with Native American athletes, of how they brought them in and played off the fact that, they weren't black, but they were still able to bring in these other players.
Well, the fascinating thing about it is baseball truly had a color line. It wasn't just black and white. They created space for red players and for brown players. And even when John McGraw was trying to sneak in an African-American player as a Native American player. Chief Takahoma is what he named the second baseman, Charlie Grant. Charles Comiskey responded saying, well, if he's going to try to sneak him in, there's a Chinaman I know that I will try to sneak in. And in fact, there was already a discussion within the sports media about yellow. Even before there was an Asian player in professional baseball in the United States, or in the major leagues, I should say. So these ideas about color were already there. Even if you weren't physically present, they already discussed it. And this is what, in fact, was going on. Vincent Nava was a Mexican-American player. And he actually played in California League under his stepfather's name. Vincent Irwin was his professional name. When the Providence Grays, that was part of the National League, sought to bring him from the West Coast to the East Coast, they're like, you know what? We like your actual name, Vincent Nava, because we can actually make some money off this. And they marketed him as the Spanish catcher of the Providence Club. And they would send placards to the towns before and say, like, come out and see him. They would have, you know, a veritable marketing campaign around the Spanish catcher. And this I used to illustrate a particular point. Brown, it was part of the color line because it enabled major league teams to profit. Because you can bring in players more cheaply out of the Caribbean, even in 1910, when the first two Cubans were brought into the major leagues, 1911 to be precise, Rafael Almeida and Armando Marsans. You sign them more cheaply, you pay them more cheaply, you make greater profit. And that's been the modus operandi to this day of how to acquire talent from the Caribbean. The Dominican Republic is part of that story. Venezuela is part of that story. Sure, you will have this occasional player who will get the nice $6 million signing bonus coming out of Dominican Republic. He's the exception. The majority of them are going to get, if they're decent, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to sign. Had that player been born in the United States and drafted the same talent level, we're talking major difference in money. Let me give you one of the anecdotes, or one of the numbers that's really fascinating. Sammy Sosa, when he signed with the Texas Rangers in 1985, I think it was, he signed for the same signing bonus that Jackie Robinson got in signing his first major league contract, $3,500.
Wow.
And, you know, you'd mentioned that and when Alex Rodriguez got signed, you know, the fact that he grew up in the U.S., he said that was a reason that his signing bonus was a lot higher than if he was going to be drafted in the Caribbean. And one of the amazing things, like, throughout the book you had talked about was the influence of the Negro Leagues on Latinos in baseball, but also the influence of African Americans in the Latin baseball circuit, which I found was kind of interesting. So if you could go into detail about that.
Yeah, again, when I mentioned before about, you know, the powerful story of the Negro Leagues, part of it is how it's the synergy between the Negro Leagues and the Latin American Leagues. Rube Foster, who founded the Negro National League in 1920, but had been trying to create a professional league in the United States since at least 1908. Foster got the idea, really, to form this league out of playing in Cuba. It was what energized him to go forward with his mission, was going to Cuba and playing in the league there and seeing a crowd who was willing to see interracial baseball, as it's perceived in the United States. It was just baseball in the Caribbean. And, you know, professional, and pay for it. They're willing to do it. And it's like, wow, we should create our own league, you know, create a structure. All fans will come out to see this if we organize correctly. That was driven largely by that experience. And the other part of that story is that the Cuban League, later on the Puerto Rican League and Dominican League and Mexican League, was very much welcoming of African-American players to play them and to pay them on par or even better than Major League players. I was sharing with my class the other day because I'm forcing them to read my book. I was sharing with them that one of the ironies of how this realm of segregation worked in professional baseball in the States was minor league players, i.e. a white Cuban, during the 1940s, made more money than your average Negro League player. However, when they return to Cuba, oftentimes that player, who the white Cuban would be the third or fourth outfielder or the third or fourth starting pitcher, and it would be the Negro League players who would be the ace of the pitching staff. And, you know, it shows how, what were the financial stakes of segregation. That is, you could be a lesser player, but if you're perceived as not black in the context of organized baseball, you can profit from that. And that's what drove part of segregation from its very inception in professional baseball. There was, for the individual player, little reason for an individual white player to protest the system of segregation when they were making more money because of that precise system.
Damien, you got any questions you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I mean, I think the, you know, this issue about profitability and marketing is sort of an interesting one. I wondered, like, do you think that's evolved at all in today's race structure and makeup in sports? Or
well, I still think that there's a Major League Baseball seeks to profit. I mean, I remember again talking with my students the other day. It's like, when I asked, what is Major League Baseball? And I was asking them to say a social institution, and they just said a profit-making business. Yeah. So they understand that dimension. I guess I didn't give them enough credit at that point. And what's interesting, and this actually brings in the whole question of Torrey Hunter, RBI Baseball. I agree with Torrey Hunter on the level of Major League Baseball needs to do more in reaching out to urban communities. Part of what I think Torrey doesn't quite fully elaborate is that U.S.-born Latinos are also less likely to make it into the major leagues, even if they're playing in the Southside Chicago high school baseball, or they're playing in South Florida, or they're playing in L.A., or they're playing in Houston. So the same barriers for Latinos and for African, well, the same barriers exist for Latinos and African Americans in terms of urban communities and getting to play the game. And what's interesting, and this is what I think Major League Baseball has backwards, is that if they invested more in the African-American community, they'll get more fans. You put the money in, and you'll profit more out of this. And again, I'm still befuddled. You know, most of us grew up, and particularly my students, grew up in the Michael Jordan era of basketball. It's all they know. Mm-hmm. But NBA basketball wasn't always so. And even now, you have LeBron, but the NBA is constantly looking for the next Michael, the next, yeah. I guess, LeBron, because they fear losing it. And there's reason for that concern, and they actively seek to make sure it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Baseball has been very much the opposite. They truly abandoned the African-American community for decades. In fact, right after integration began, one of the things that Major League Baseball did was ultimately destroy the infrastructure in African-American communities that produced the black baseball player. And ultimately, by the 80s, a generation or two after integration had begun, many of these players had switched to football and switched to basketball. Why is this so? Where do you go after you play? And particularly today, you make so much money that unless you're Antoine Walker, you don't have to worry about money after your career. But in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when you weren't, before the era of free agency, when you weren't making this money, African American players would desire to become coaches, become high school coaches, college coaches, professional coaches. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until 1971 that the first African American period was hired to have a managerial position within organized baseball. And then it was the following year when Frank Robinson gets hired. So that means from 47 till 72, there's not a single African-American manager, when there was right across the board African-American managers of teams in the Negro Leagues, and you had some Latinos managing the Negro Leagues. But the other dimension, this gets back to the dynamic of Latin America. In Latin America, you had African-American managers that were managing white major leaguers in the winter leagues.
Sure.
So it wasn't like they didn't have the experience. There was something else going on, which is, in fact, institutional racism that prevented. And so what happens is these individuals who might have become a coach, that might have helped produce the next generation of baseball players, they turned to other sports. And I'll give you an anecdote from my own years in high school. Went to high school in South Florida at this school called Pompano Beach Ely High School. And in, I think it was like 2004, Pompano Beach Ely High School had the highest per capita in terms of students into NFL players, because they had about 8 of our high school, the kids who graduated from our high school were now in the NFL. Al Harris is one of them.
Okay.
And one of our assistant football coaches was Felix Chin Evans. And the name didn't mean anything. Coach Evans is all I knew until I was doing research for my dissertation. I was reading a book called The Biographical Encyclopedia of the Negro Leagues. And I come across the name Felix Chin Evans. And he was an all-star in the Negro Leagues.
Wow.
Chin Evans pitched in numerous East-West games for the Memphis Red Sox. And in his post-playing days, he had nothing to do with the baseball team at Ely, where I played. He was one of the assistant football coaches. That's how far removed he had placed himself from the game, because he saw no future for him in the game.
Mm-hmm.
He turned to football, and he helped create, you know, this football factory in South Florida. That's what the institutional neglect of Major League Baseball created. And now that's what they must attend to bring those that community back.
Sure.
Yeah, and for those of you that were wondering what Torrey Hunter's comments were, it was, quote, "People see dark faces out there, and the perception is that they're African American. They're not us. They're imposters. Even people I know come up and say, 'Hey, what color is Vladimir Guerrero? Is he a black player?' I say, 'Come on, he's Dominican. He's not black.' As African American players, we have a theory that baseball can go get an imitator and pass them off as us. It's like they had to go get some dark faces, so they go to the Dominican or Venezuela because you can get them cheaper. It's like, why should I get this kid from the south side of Chicago and have Scott Boras represent him, pay him $5 million when you can get a Dominican guy for a bag of chips? I'm telling you, it's sad." And then later on, he ended up elaborating on the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim sports blog. "What troubles me most was the word imposters appearing in reference to Latin American players not being black players. It was a wrong word choice, and it definitely doesn't accurately reflect now how I feel and who I am. What I meant to say was, they're not black players. They're Latin American players. There's a difference culturally."
And what I responded to, and I actually wrote a piece that Joe Posnowski, who writes for Sports Illustrated, posted on his blog. I called it, "Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?" And it's that, Torrey, they're black. They're not African American. They're not U.S. born black, but they're black. If you go back to the era of segregation, they're segregated. They're in the Negro Leagues, as he would have been during that era. So, you know, don't get it twisted. They're black. You're right. They're not African American, and there's an important distinction there. But you cannot deny them their blackness. An anecdote from the life of Louis Tiant. Jim Mudcat Grant, who played in the Negro Leagues and also played a while in the Major Leagues, he created a group called the Black Aces. It was a marketing scheme that he created. It was a great brainstorm. All the Black Aces who were 20 game winners in the Major Leagues were going to go on a tour. So Mike Norris and Mudcat and a couple of other guys, there were 8. And Louis Tiant's like, "Hey, what about me? I won 20 games in the Major Leagues. I'm black." And they're like, and basically they excluded him from them. They're like, "You're not black." And as Torrey Hunter would say, "You're not us." the fascinating dynamic of that is Louis Tiant's father pitched 2 decades in the Negro Leagues. You know, he is us. He's not African American. But if you want to talk about the story of racial exclusion in the game and the power of race in that game, he's in there. You know, so you're now making a decision to excise them. And the point I also made at a presentation, I actually gave a talk at University of Wyoming. They want to hear about Latinos in baseball. All right, I was out there. And the point I made is we often see these statistics from the Richard Lapchick report card on integration and diversity in professional sports. And it talks about the high watermark of black participation in Major League Baseball and where it peaked in 1973. Well, what that number includes are all the black Latinos. They were counted as black. And so when we say that the ratio of African Americans in baseball is 10, that's correctly stated. But if you're saying the ratio of black players in baseball is about 10%, that's when it's misstated. And it's one thing for Torrey Hunter to kind of point to that 28% in 1973 and say those were the glory days. Well, if you're going to count the Latinos there, you got to count them now. You can't conveniently say, sorry, Vlad, you're not black, you're not us, because you're gerrymandering the numbers. And again, the same forces that limit the opportunities of a Southside Chicago Mexican or Puerto Rican American player from making it to the major leagues is what's affecting those in Compton, you know, and elsewhere. I mean, East LA. And that's what Major League Baseball has to attend to.
Yeah, and you had mentioned in the book, Ruben Gomez saying, you know, the crazy thing about race is in America is you speak Spanish, you're not black.
And it lives on today. I mean, it's fascinating. You know, so if you're from Kenya and you don't speak English, then you're not black, I guess.
I guess you might also be not be able to be president either, according right. to Mayor Schweikart.
See that loop? Lift it all the way back.
Yeah, some of the amazing stuff, being a longtime White Sox fan, was the history of Minnie Minoso coming up, along with, you know, Bill Veeck when he was with Cleveland franchise signing up players. And that was one of the major reasons that Judge Landis, who, as members of the IWW, we dislike for, you know, kicking out Big Bill Haywood and Emma Goldman and others, as well as, you know, helping to keep the color line in place quite vigorously, was the struggle of black Latinos. And you had mentioned sometimes negotiating their way through, you know, if they were in a segregated restaurant or a segregated hotel, they would accent their Spanish language or conveniently forget any English that they knew and be able to get served. And then, you know, even like when Vic Power said, you know, when he talked about on the field, you know, he's like, I was accepted, you know, they didn't care. But he's like, after the game, I was just another black guy.
You know, and Vic Power recalled one time when he's playing with the Cleveland Indians, and he had his Cadillac, his convertible, and he lived in I forget if it was Shaker Heights or Lake Park, one of the ritzy suburbs of Cleveland. And he was constantly being pulled over in his own neighborhood by the various police officers, and they would come up and finally realize when they come upon this person in the car who it was. And it's like, oh, big fan, routine traffic stop, you can go on your way. And it's like, he knew what was going on. He understood. And, you know, part, to get a little, you know, academic here, you know, part of what I try to show through those examples is how individuals can manipulate race and kind of displace power for the moment in playing with accents. But ultimately, it reinforces the system. You have to be brown and not black to be served at those restaurants, and so you emphasize your accent. But it was something also that not just Latinos did, that African Americans also had that knowledge. James Weldon Johnson talks about it in his autobiography along this way. He grew up in Jacksonville, where there were lots of Cubans, and he picked up some Cuban words. And a couple of times Johnson was able to not go be forced into the colored car on trains in the South because he mimicked the Spanish accent. And that once in a while it works, and you feel like you're getting away with something. But ultimately, it doesn't overthrow the system. It just toys with the system, and it provides momentary relief.
Now, you had mentioned, uniqueness of Spanish-speaking American Latino players and their entry into baseball, with, you know, the fact that they were some of these integration pioneers, and they were the first ones to actually start dealing with the color line and really the first ones testing it. And that story kind of gets lost. And even when they got here, a lot of them, you know, especially had to deal with not only the cultural divide but the basic language divide of, you know, something simple as getting food.
You know, and in fact, you know, Minoso is a very powerful figure in that story. Here's a player who enters in the Negro Leagues first, spent several years, and I still consider myself one of those who try to champion his cause for the Hall of Fame. Because of the time he spent in the Negro Leagues, is actually not considered. Major League Baseball, or I should say the Hall of Fame, its rules say you either are a Negro Leaguer or you are a Major Leaguer when you go into consideration. And in Minoso's case, his 3 years in the Negro Leagues, where he was an all-star, are discounted. And, you know, he had the misfortune of being signed by one of the most aggressive teams to integrate, the Cleveland Indians. And he actually stood behind other black players waiting for his shot. Whereas if he had signed with another team, or excuse me, better stated, if his services had not been sold from the New York Cubans to the Cleveland Indians, but rather to say the Boston Braves, he would have gotten an earlier shot. And so his career was deeply affected by the fact that he was an integration pioneer. He was part of that generation. And this is one of the anecdotes I often talk about, dealt with that kind of intra-black debate, discussion, tension, when some of his own teammates would say, and Suit Kate Simpson being one of the major ones, saying, "You're not black because you're Cuban. You don't deal with race the same way we do." And in fact, Minoso actually just represented another way of dealing with race that some African Americans themselves engaged in. It's just that since he's Cuban, he's Spanish speaking, dominant, somewhat bilingual, he's considered, "Oh well, you must have it easier." His story is one of what's going on in 1951 in Chicago, and this is what many people forget. Here he's uniting parts of the South Side, rallying around the Sox. But in Cicero, they're firebombing the first black couple to move into an apartment building. The mayor has to call out the national governor, I should say, has to call out the National Guard. This is what's going on in Chicago. And on the South Side, you have this black Cuban. And there's a very small Cuban community in Chicago. There's a bigger, growing at that moment, Puerto Rican community and a significant Mexican community. But he's one of a handful of Cubans probably in the entire city. And he's the only one going through what he's going through. And he can't just turn to the African-American community and find solace, comfort, and everything he needs. And yet, he was amazing. And to me, the achievements of the integration pioneers, it's an added star to what they do. Because imagine doing this with all that pressure. This is the embodiment of Jackie Robinson's greatness. It's to know they're going to come at you and still beat them. To understand that they're going to throw the kitchen sink at you in terms of the barrage of tricks of the game, curse words, everything, and to still perform at that level. That is the legacy of Robinson, and that's what others like Minoso did. To me, I often refer to them, that's baseball's greatest generation. Because they knew what was coming, and they were willing to fight and overcome. And Robinson is the lead figure in this generation, but he's not the lone figure. And again, that's what I hope to do with my book, is to illustrate. And an example I often give when I speak on college campuses for students to get a grasp of how long it takes for every major league team to have at least one black player have performed on their team once. 1947, Robinson starts it. 1959, the Boston Red Sox have Pumpsy Green appear, completing the 16 major league teams having at least one black player. That's from entering kindergarten to your marching down to pomps and circumstances, graduating high school. That's how long it took for Major League Baseball to complete that process of having just one black player on their team. And in that story is Minnie Minoso. In that story is Ozzie Virgil. There's a number of black Latinos who are part of that story. And I was able to interview Ozzie Virgil a couple of years ago when we were celebrating the 50th anniversary of him breaking the color line with the Detroit Tigers. And Virgil, in an aside, said, some of these guys here who are talking about some of the old Tigers, they kind of tell me now that you weren't really the first black because I'm Dominican. And it's like, but you look at the Michigan Chronicle, a black newspaper published out of Detroit, they're celebrating the heck out of the fact that this is the first black man. So there's this revisionist trend even to kind of erase the story of the Latinos who were part of that integration generation from the storybooks. And it lessens the story of Robinson, and it lessens the story of the march towards civil rights that baseball played a part of by erasing the Latino part of the story. Again, I was speaking at the Negro League Baseball Museum a couple of years ago when the book first came out, and afterwards, an older guy, Latino, Mexican ancestry, comes up to me with tears in his eyes, and it's like, I had no idea we were part of the story. I grew up in Kansas City, and actually he grew up in Kansas City, Kansas. And he's like, we were taught about this whole story about the Kansas City Monarchs and the Negro Leagues, and never had I been told that we were part of this story. And what's amazing about that is, in 1926, when the Kansas City Monarchs hired a new manager, the owner of the team, who's actually a white guy, J.L. Wilkinson, hires Jose Mendez, his black pitcher, to be his manager, black Cuban. And Mendez is given the realms of what really is the New York Yankees of the Negro Leagues. That's who the owner entrusted the team's future with. And they would go on to go to back-to-back World Series under Mendez's helm. And the importance of that is, that's how close the story of black Cubans and black Latinos in the Negro League is to the actual core of the Negro League story. And yet, we constantly see it be erased. And it's something to me that's very important to recapture so that people can better understand that the story of race has always been complicated and has always involved more than black and white. And it has involved brown and others.
Yeah, that was probably one of the most amazing part to me in the book, was that whole, just the rich history that doesn't normally get discussed or doesn't normally get brought up. Going into some more modern stuff, Sports Illustrated just did a report that Sandy Alderson, the Major League Baseball's Dominican Republic point man, said that Major League Baseball is going to have a scouting bureau that's going to expand to include its operations in Latin America now, to try to get out from under the thumb of some of the issues like the Cleveland Indians signing the 15-year-old kid and then hiding him until he was 17 to be able to legally sign, and then trying to spread apart his signing bonus and deal with some of those issues. Even if you could go into the Washington Nationals scandal that they had had.
And part of this is, it's just not a recent history. It's how Major League Baseball has always approached Latin America. And so now they're trying to, and what fascinates me is, they're trying to present this as a Dominican problem. This is not a Dominican problem of their own making, that is, of the Dominican making. This is a problem out of the institution of baseball and how it's long approached. The Yankees, for example, signed one of my favorite players, Bernie Williams, when he was 15, and they sent him up in a boarding school in Connecticut till he turned 16, and then he was legally allowed to sign. As a Puerto Rican, Bernie was a U.S. citizen, so they didn't have to deal with the visa stuff, but he was still too young to legally sign. And also, Puerto Ricans were not yet part of the Major League draft. And so, that's part of a long history of how age has been manipulated by team and player. And what fascinates me is how Seeley gets up there and really tries to present this as, we have to deal with the cultural dynamics and issues of the Dominican Republic because this is how they do things. And it's like, no, it's not just how they do things, how they learned from you how the system works, and they've manipulated to get some money out of it too. Because, the greater policing of ages is only going to mean trying to get players for cheaper. Ultimately, that's the motive. Yes, they're saying, they're trying to protect their investment. But the key part in there is not protect, but investment. Is they're trying to invest cheaply and reap the greatest reward. I often talk to my students here about, consider the difference between Carlos Zambrano and Mark Pryor. Who was the golden boy in the Chicago Cubs system? Who got the big money? And how long does Zambrano have to wait till he gets his big contract? He was right when he became arbitration eligible, he gets the contract. But that's 4 years into his major league career. He had been part of the organization almost 10 years. Mark Pryor got $12 million coming out of USC.
And promptly fell apart after the 2003 World Series, which every time on a bad day, I just sit and watch and laugh to no end in Game 6 and Game 7.
A true Sox fan, I hear.
Oh, yes. Yes, I have my two favorite teams, the White Sox and whoever happens to be playing the Cubs that day.
And the dynamic of it is, Pryor had all the benefits of a U.S. education, U.S. nutrition, U.S. training, and, Zambrano was really a young teenager coming out of Venezuela. And that, to me, is another part of the story. Is, you take these teenage boys, and we can all think about, there's three guys here present, what kind of knuckleheads we were at 16.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you're a professional player in a different country. Now go be mature. It's like, And that is the dynamic that Dominican and Venezuelan players are placed in when they go into rookie ball.
And even make sure, you know, you're able to negotiate the culture, know the language. And, you know, it's like, you know, dropping us off in another country. And it's like, all right, guys, go be mature and make sure you negotiate everything really, really well. And good luck.
Yeah. And so, you know, some of the major league organizations have gotten a lot better. They've gotten individuals to help help these players get accustomed to what's going on. The actual next book I'm working on deals with this guy, Alex Montes, that owned the New York Cubans, who was actually hired by the New York Giants to be that kind of cultural ambassador, cultural bridge. And again, what works is not old, it's not recent as well. There's like historical lessons here. But Major League Baseball, in pursuit of profit, has often abandoned those kinds of things. You know, those cultural schools disappeared. Alex Montes and his former shortstop, who was his Dominican scout, his name was Horacio Martinez, at the Giants' spring training camp, actually had English language classes for the Dominican and other Latino players in 1962. Yet when Montes leaves, he dies in 74, and Martinez is not as a significant figure within the Giants' hierarchy as Montes was, you know, that system deteriorated. And it's in the most recent years now, in the 2000s, where we see major league teams institute those same programs that had worked. Look at the Giants lineup of the 1960s. You know, the Cepedas, the Marichals, the Pagans, the Alou brothers, the Willie Kirklands, the Willie McCoveys. All those guys actually were signed by Alex Montes. And he was part of the innovation that had been created in the Negro Leagues, and the Giants were just smart enough to get them and apply that to how they approached integration. But they're one of less than a handful of teams that actually did that. Most of them said, you know what, we'll just send, like the Boston Red Sox, we'll just send our white scout down to Birmingham, Alabama to look at Willie Mays. And the guy basically said, it rains the first day, I didn't want to wait around to see Willie Mays play. So he wrote up a bad scouting report, and that was it. You know, Mays doesn't get signed by, you know, doesn't even get offered. And so the Red Sox, okay, yes, I'm a Yankees fan, but the Red Sox did.
You know, you can't be perfect.
We all have our crosses. And, you know, that is part of the story of not just the near misses, but how race operated within baseball. And, you know, understanding those stories actually empowers us to talk about how Major League Baseball needs to be doing things now.
Yeah, that was a very excellent. Thank you for coming in. This has been a really interesting hour. And if you haven't read it, again, it is Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line. With us for the past hour has been Dr. Adrian Burgos. It was a pleasure for having you on the air. And you'll be able to catch us next week, Not Another Sports Show, on 104.5 FM. Thank you for tuning in.
Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome.